welcome. Thank you for coming out on this wet, gray day. Inside here, it feels like it's sunny because of all your bright and shining faces. So we appreciate seeing you today and having you come out. We're really excited about today's presentation. And I want to just do a little bit of housekeeping first. We're going to have Holly take pictures, or at least one picture, and we promise you won't show up on Instagram. This is just for our contact tracing purposes, if needed, and also in lieu of passing around the pre-pandemic sign-up sheet. Remember that? We used to pass that around, take attendance that way. Well, we've changed things up a bit. So, that's it for the housekeeping. And yes, I dropped my glasses. Thank you. Thank you. What we're going to do now is introduce our speaker. And I have that right here. We're really excited to entertain today and to host Camaria M. Bird McAllister, who was elected to be an ordained itinerant deacon in the African Methodist Episcopal Church and serves with her husband at Heard AME Church in Roseville, New Jersey. She is currently a third year at Princeton Theological Seminary and first year at Rutgers University School of Social Work in the Joint Dual Degree Program. This morning, she'll tell us about her background and what led her to seminary. She will also share with us what she learned at PTS and how she is making it matter on the ground in her life and ministry. Please join me in welcoming Camaria.
Thank you so much for the introduction, and I am excited to be here this morning, a little nervous as well, but that's okay. As you already heard, I bring you greetings from Heard AME Church in Roselle, New Jersey, also Princeton Seminary and Rutgers University, which I'll talk about a little later. But before I get started, if it's okay, I'd like to open up in prayer. Dear God, we thank you for another day. We thank you for allowing us to see a morning that we haven't seen thus far, God. We ask that you would be present in this place, God. And we just invite you into this place and this lesson and this talk, God. And we ask that your name just be praised. In all of these things, we ask in your holy and precious name, Jesus, we say amen and amen. Before we get started, I just wanted to let you know how I plan on structuring today's talk. I first plan on just giving you some background on myself and how I got to seminary, and then how I'm taking the lessons of seminary and making it matter on the ground, meaning applying that to my life and ministry. So first of all, I am a Jersey girl to the bone. I was born and raised in New Jersey. I grew up in South Jersey, Cherry Hill area, and then around middle school, I moved to Princeton, and so I have been here most of my life. And also, I was born into, raised in the AME Church. The AME Church is stands for the African Methodist Episcopal Church. So we are Methodist by doctrine, but the way we govern is Episcopalian, and so we have bishops pretty much. And the AME Church, while we're here, the AME Church is the first black denomination in the United States. We started in 1787 after black parishioners left St. George's Episcopal Methodist Episcopal Church after they were praying, and some of the church leaders, that was a predominantly white church, told them that they were not able to pray there, so they interrupted their prayers. And I'm not sure what took place prior, but I'm sure other things took place. But as a result, this was pretty much the last straw, and they walked out of St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, and they started, Richard Allen and Absalom Jones started the Free African Society, which was a black community organization that really empowered the black community. And from that, Richard Allen started the African Methodist Episcopal Church. So the church was started out of social justice, and that's just something that I wanted to share with you all. But so I was raised in that church. My grandfather was a bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and both of my parents were ordained itinerant elders in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, my father being a pastor, my mother being assistant pastor, both bivocational. So I'm just letting you know that I grew up in the church, and I was there all the time. I never felt like I was forced to be there. I liked to be there. All my friends were there. Fun activities were there. So I was there. But it wasn't until college where I started saying, oh, I'll go next Sunday. And next Sunday really never came. And I wasn't really participating as much as I would have like to. And I also realized in that space that I needed to find God for myself. I needed to have my own faith. And through some life experiences, I was able to build a stronger relationship with God and went back to the church and got re-involved. I went to TCNJ, and I had also started working with kids. I worked in Boys and Girls Club of Trenton and Mercer County. And then while working with them, I did like a lot of different activities and homework help. But while working with them, I realized that what they were struggling with was more than just homework help. And I wanted to be able to work with them more. And so I went to Rider University for my Master's of Organizational Leadership and Counseling Related Services because I wanted to start a program for youth. And while there, another position opened up called the CARES Program, which is a partial hospitalization program for kids in Trenton. It's located at St. Francis Medical Center, working with kids from 3 to 15 or 16. And so that was, I loved it. I was there for almost 10 years before coming to seminary, but I really felt called to continue my work with youth and families. And during this time, maybe about 4 years before coming to seminary, I started ministering, but not realizing that I was ministering, but I was sharing with other people about my experience with God and that kind of stuff. And people were telling me, oh, you're going to be a minister, pastor. And I'm like, absolutely not. Like, that's my parents' thing. That's not something that I will ever do. So no, it's not happening. And so it just continued, and I just couldn't let it. It just wouldn't let me go. So I finally surrendered and said, all right, God, whatever it is that you want me to do is what I'm going to do. And then in deep prayer and fasting, I'm like, okay, I'm saying I'm gonna accept my call, now what? And it pretty much was apply to Princeton Seminary, and I'm like, yeah, right, not me. And then also too, I was wrestling with the fact of, okay, how would I, you want me to go to seminary, but I know for sure that you've also called me to do this clinical work and working with kids, so. I'm like, I don't really see how this is going to work, but okay, fine. But I did apply. I did get in. And having no idea that they actually had a dual degree program there, you know, and it's just interesting how sometimes we question God and God has already created the space for you already before you get there. So I'm grateful for that. And I'm still shocked that that I'm actually in my third year of Princeton Seminary, not thinking that, one, I could get in, and if I did get in, being able to do well seemed so far-fetched. And so I'm just grateful that the Lord has led me here in this space and that I'm still here, and so I'm just appreciative of that, more so than I thought. I didn't think I was going to be crying, but and right before I prior to starting seminary, my boyfriend at the time had proposed, who just so happens to be also an ordained elder in the AME church and a pastor. And so I only say that to say that the church that we are at now, the few months before we got married, he was appointed to a church of a decent size. And as far as ministerial staff, it's just been him and this other woman who is ready to retire. So it's really just me and him at this moment. And I only say that to say that I am a full-time student in an active ministry in a church. And so when thinking about how I wanted to sum up all of this, I came up with making it matter on the ground, because I'm someone that is 1 foot in the classroom, 1 foot in ministry. And so I'm just explaining the topic of making it matter on the ground, in that taking the lessons of the ivory tower and making them using that to make it matter on the ground. So the ivory tower being a frequently used metaphor as this place that is separated from the rest of the world and kind of sits high in this place of privilege. And so I kind of see that as Princeton Seminary, as the ivory tower, and making those things that I'm learning, making that matter to the people that I am ministering to out on the ground. And I thought it would be a good idea, since this is Sunday school, to invite you to look at a text. You can look at it later on, but I'm thinking of the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, verses 2 through 29. They are two stories that, if you look at the text, they seemingly seem disconnected, but it's the passage where Jesus goes up to the mountainside and he brings a couple of the disciples. And up top in the mountainside, there are miracles taking place. I believe it says that Jesus's robe turns white, and Elijah is seen, Moses is seen. These miracles are taking place. But at the same time that these miracles are taking place, there is a boy who's being thrown on the ground by, he's possessed by demons, and there's a father that is helpless. And so So you have these two stories, and they connect when Jesus comes from the mountaintop and comes down to the ground and heals the boy. And even the father prior was saying, you know, these disciples, you know, they couldn't help him. And it's interesting because these are the disciples that were, you know, front row seats to all of what Jesus was doing, but they were unable to make that, you know, impact on the ground. So I just wanted to add that as a guiding text for us this morning in talking about making things matter on the ground. So here I am, 1 foot in the classroom, 1 foot in the ivory tower, 1 foot on the ground, 1 foot in ministry. And so I just wanted to just lay that kind of background, lay that foundation before I get into what I am doing with the things that I'm learning. There's so many different things that I'm learning, and so I tried my best to organize it, to organize it all to make it make sense. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about was one of the first classes I took my first semester was taught by someone named Dr. Heath Carter. I'm not sure if you all are familiar with him, but I took his course. And in talking about, you know, making things matter on the ground, it was social Christianity. So we talked a lot about the social gospel and how different people were using their theology and using the things that they learned about to make change in their communities. And so One of the assignments that we had was an archival project. I had never done anything with archives. If you had asked me what my worst subject was, it would be between math and history, usually history, because I always thought that history was boring. Maybe I just didn't have the right teachers, and I just felt like it wasn't relevant. But I really appreciate taking that course because I realized that history is very relevant, and it's something that I really appreciated. So for that project, I decided to look at women in ministry in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and I called it God is a Negro Woman, which is a play off of Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, which is one of the bishops of the AME Church, who wrote about God is a Negro and really challenged the way people look at God. And so that's what I called it. I loved it. I realized that I really enjoy being in the archives and seeing, you know, all of these amazing things. And then from there, I worked with him again. We started in the J term looking at race at PTS post 1865. I'm not sure if you all are familiar, but Princeton Seminary did a slavery audit. And so they looked at how the seminary their relationship and with slavery and things like that. And so we looked at, well, what happened afterwards? So we were looking at what was going on campus, the students. And so from that, I began becoming interested in looking at Black alumni at Princeton Seminary, mostly earlier. I found some really awesome people. So I wanted to share a couple of them with you. A.J. Molden. She's the first Black woman to graduate from Princeton Theological Seminary. She graduated with her Master's of Religious Education in 1952, which is, you know, monumental. And at that time, many of the women, they studied education, because at that time, not many women were being affirmed for being able to preach and be ordained and things like that. But so she was highly active on campus. She was also just a cool tidbit about her is that she was apparently this awesome pitcher in her state and also on campus. But she did a lot of work with youth in her community and was on different commissions and things like that. Also, Reverend Dr. Prathia Hall Wynn, not sure if you're familiar, but an amazing Black woman. She graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary with her Master's of Divinity in 1982. Also, her Master's of Theology in 1984 and her Doctor of Philosophy in 1997. Her doctoral dissertation was on the religious and social conscience of African American Baptist women. Hall was also one of the first Black women ordained in the American Baptist Churches of USA and went on to become the pastor of her father's church. She also, prior to coming to Princeton Seminary, she was heavily involved in the civil rights movement, and she was a part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And she became the first woman field organizer of SNCC in Southwest Georgia. Also, something took place while they were there. The Ku Klux Klan, they had burned down about two churches in her area, and she decided to have a prayer vigil. And who was there but Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King? And while she was praying, she continued to say, "I have a dream," over and over again. And he actually was inspired by that prayer. And so the "I have a dream" speech is from the prayer of Prathia Hall, which is pretty cool. And then also, this is more Presbyterian stuff, so you like it. Lawrence Brooks Ellerson, he graduated in 1896. He pastored 13th Avenue Presbyterian Church, which he built into the first self-supporting Negro congregation of its denomination in the North. And the article that I found also mentioned that he graduated from Biddle University, which is an HBCU. He was also elected four times to represent the North Presbytery as the commissioner of the General Assembly, which is pretty big. Also, another alumni is Ulysses B. Blakely. He graduated in 1948. And he's someone that I discovered in one of my initial reports, but he was a part of the group of students that went to Selma and the Selma Montgomery March. And he also became a co-pastor of Chicago's oldest Protestant church, the First Presbyterian Church. And it was a historic appointment because it says, "A colored and a white minister Sunday offered prayers for the success of their pastorate of an integrated congregation in the first official act as co-pastors. It was the first time in the history of the Presbyterian Church in the United States that a colored and white minister shared a pulpit as co-pastors." The article also that I was looking at goes on to say that they both serve dual capacity with equal status. Not really sure about that, but that the church had 1,000 members and 100 of them were colored. Blakely was also a chaplain of the U.S. Army and held rank as lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve. He also was the vice moderator of the Presbyterian of Chicago in 1960. And 2 years later, he made history again for the second time in its history. The Presbytery of Chicago has elected a non-white as moderator, and that was Reverend Ulysses B. Blakely. And then lastly, I just wanted to lift up another student, James Marmaduke Boddy, who graduated in 1895, who pastored Siloam Presbyterian Church, which I noticed in my research, there were a number of Black students that graduated from Princeton Seminary that pastored at this church. But something, he was really amazing. He He was a medical student at University in Albany. In 1905, Booker T. Washington included Body's article, The Ethnology of the Japanese Race, in his magazine, Colored American Magazine. So Booker T. Washington wrote about him a lot. And he was a prominent black scholar and one of the earliest African-American writers to tackle the issue of black presence in ancient East, specifically China and Japan. But he was actively engaged in the interest of his race brothers, and he was always to be found in the forefront of any fight for advancement of the Negro. There's a bunch of stuff on him. So he also wrote an essay, Brain Weight and Intellectual Development, Physical Variations of the Negro and the Anglo-Saxon Races. And it states that in this essay, he melded his training in science and theology to form an argument against those who promoted white supremacy under the guise of phrenological science. In addition, there were other clippings of him. He moved throughout Africa as well. I also found letters between him and W.E.B. Du Bois, which I thought was cool. And so he's just another... one of the many interesting people that I have found. There are so many, and we do not have the time to go through all of them, but it's just something that I felt was important as a African-American student at Princeton Seminary. It's very easy to feel out of place and that you don't belong there. So it's it was really important for me to be able to see these students and see that I am, you know, I do have a place here. And it's also important to, a lot of times we only maybe lift up maybe one or two names. What's important for people to know that Princeton Seminary has a long legacy of amazing students of color that have done really, really great work even prior to coming to seminary and then after coming to seminary. So I thought it was important, imperative for us to lift up those voices that sometimes go unheard. And then also, not necessarily a history class, but Dr. Lisa Bowens, who is a New Testament scholar. I took her course in African American Pauline hermeneutics, and she talks a lot about, there's a lot of history in there, and it was an amazing class. And so I just wanted to share an excerpt of a paper that I wrote. Acts 17:26, which reads, "And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation." It's a prominent Pauline text used by early African American interpreters. The New Testament scholar Dr. Lisa Bowens explains that this text persists among African American writers during this time period, for in it they see a refutation of unjust laws, racism, slavery, and white supremacy. And I found that class to be super important because a lot of times the narrative is, you know, white people taught African Americans, you know, the Bible and all of these things, but it was just amazing to be able to read about the fact that people that were enslaved were able to interpret the Bible for themselves and to find the power and to find freedom in the Bible, and they used it, and we looked at different things. People were writing appeals. People were writing for their freedom while enslaved and using the text to do so. And so I found that to be extremely powerful. Also, just to kind of switch gears a little bit, because I am interested in clinical social work, I did want to lift up a couple of things that I learned as far in pastoral care and mental health, which I'm interested in. I took a course called Transformation of Shame, which was a pretty powerful course, and I learned about the importance of ministers, church leaders, people being able to be aware of their own shame and how they deal with it, because depending on how you deal with it, maybe the way you approach others in your ministry. And so it was a very self-reflective course. And also just to be mindful of shame-based theologies that sometimes are preached and taught, and being more mindful of the way that you minister to people. And then also another course that I took was Sleep, Surrender, and Sabbath, which was a beautiful course. You know, it's very easy, especially being in seminary, to become consumed and overwhelmed with all of the work and assignments that are going on, even in ministry, being overwhelmed with all of the things that you have to do. And it's very imperative that we are getting rest. And I know it can be very difficult and challenging to do so. But so I learned about the importance of rest on the body and the physical effects that it can have. There are also tons of work and studies about the effect of lack of sleep and that they could be connected to different ailments, diseases, things like that. So it's really important to take care of yourself. Also, that true rest is surrender. I never thought about it like that before, but a lot of times, you know, you might take a vacation or you might go to sleep, but you're still thinking about those things that you have to do. And so it's going to take a level of surrender and just being able to trust God to take care of those things while, you know, you're not there. And so that was very beneficial to me. Also knowing that rest is about grace was super helpful for me, that we're offered rest not by not because of anything that we've done, but God offers us rest freely. And so that is something that I thought was pretty powerful and helpful and something that definitely can be translated on the ground and making sure that people are staying healthy and we're creating safe spaces in our churches and communities for people. And then finally, I just wanted to talk about, there's so many different theology, ethics courses. I really couldn't put it into one one course. But pretty much, you know, from all of these different courses, learning to create my own hermeneutic and the way that I look at the text and examine how I approach the Bible. Prior to coming to seminary, I just thought about it as me just approaching it as myself. But from taking a lot of the different courses, I learned about when I approach the Bible, I approach it having other people in mind. And I also learned about my own blind spots. Even as an African-American woman, I still am fully aware that I grew up in a place of privilege. I'm in Princeton Seminary. I'm also cisgendered and heterosexual. And so that is something that I also have been dealing with. And also thinking about, you know, people that have other things that are going on and how that can be taken for other people. And then also this idea of God, God of the oppressed. It's a lot of that from different writings and works of liberation theologians and different books and texts that we have reading and thinking about reading from the margins and thinking about not reading from a place of privilege. And also I read this pretty cool article from Bell Hooks, who wrote about choosing the margins. And she was just talking about, you know, growing up in the margins, but you know, finding success and being kind of in the center, and that she has to actively choose to stay within the margins and think of those that are on the margins, but she's doing that. And then also just this fact of that theology is an action word. We are something that we're doing. You're not just having your theology, it's affecting people when you do it. And theology calls us to do something, and God calls us to do something. The final thing that I wanted just to share is over the summer, I started working with a group called Salvation and Social Justice. It's a faith-based group. It's a public policy group, and it's an advocacy group, and they are focused on looking at things that are going on in the world, specifically in the state of New Jersey, and finding a theological framework for these things. I'm not sure if any of you watched, there was a documentary about the Black Church by Henry Louis Gates, yes. And in there, Reverend William Barber, he stated, people know there's something wrong with a religion that has nothing to say about the oppressive realities and, about the oppressive realities that exist in life. And so I thought that was pretty powerful that he said that. But this group is showing that the things that are going on, that God has something to say about them. So they have people that are working in housing, people that are working in education, people that are working in policing, people that are working on incarceration, people that are working on Black maternal health, because we know there's a disparity there, and then also trying to find a theological framework for them. They work on this theory of change, which is getting people from lamentation to liberation, and doing the work to do so. But that was an organization that I felt I thought was pretty powerful, and one that I felt like sharing about, because there are people that are doing the work. And so I just came to share how I'm making sense of what I'm learning in seminary and how I am using that to impact my own ministry and my community as well. I think it's important that we continue to think about, you know, it's nice that if your sanctuary is beautiful, you're having these amazing activities and things like that, but it doesn't necessarily matter if you're not able to connect with anyone outside of here. You're not able to connect with the people and speak to the things that are happening, because there are a lot of things that are happening in our world. And I believe that we are all divinely mandated to help out and to do what we can to make the world a better place. But so that's pretty much most of what I had to say. Hopefully you have questions and we can engage in some dialogue before it's time for us to go. And yeah.
I have a question. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. No. So I'm starting social work right now.
Okay.
So prior to coming to seminary, I worked as a counselor.
Okay.
So I knew that I couldn't help them as much as I wanted to because I didn't have a clinical license. In order to get the clinical license, I needed to go to the Master's of Social Work. But Princeton has a dual program with Rutgers University. So during my third year is my blended year. So right now I'm taking classes at the seminary and I'm taking classes at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, my social work classes. And then after I finish seminary, praise God, May of 2022, then I'll just have another year of just solely Rutgers social work. No.
A little more exploratory.
Mm-hmm. I for myself, it was a little more exploratory, and also I felt the call on my life was serious, and I knew that if I'm going to be ministering to people, if I'm going to be helping people, I want to be knowledgeable. And so I really did come here to learn as much as I could. I'm open to different perspectives on things. I don't really shun away from people that I disagree with, but I'm trying to learn more about how other people read the Bible, right? About how other people view God. And so that's been good for me. But also it is a requirement in the AMI Church, if you want to be ordained, that you must attend a seminary. But even if they didn't make that a requirement, I would have gone to seminary because I really am. And although both of my parents actually did go to Princeton Seminary as well, they have taught me some of the things that they have learned as well. But I still just wanted to learn things for myself. Right now I'm taking queer hermeneutics, which is something that I've thought about, but I don't know anything about it. And so I'm really interested in seeing, you know, other perspectives and things like that, if that makes sense. Okay. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I definitely found that. That's in like one of my first reports, because the first time I wasn't solely focused on, you know, each person in their profile. I was more so interested to see their experiences. And so there were definitely times I found notes, people writing home about, you know, going out with one of their black classmates and trying to get ice cream down. I don't know which place here, but they were going for ice cream and the people refused to serve them. People going to a conference and seeing the struggle of those places not being accepting of some of their black students. So there are tidbits of it. It's not as like straightforward, but in reading between the lines, you are able to see some of the struggles that that students went through. Also, I believe, I don't have my notes in front of me, but I believe there also was like a rule at Princeton University that black students at the time, they weren't able to attend, but actually President Makash, he allowed them to sit in his lecture. So that was kind of a bigger deal, but there definitely were struggles.
When did they actually intentionally admit people of color to the seminary? Do you know that?
Intentionally admit. That was early 1800s. I don't know the date. Maybe Dr. Carter knows the date. is it?
So it would have been around the same time that our church was struggling with those issues. What was around the Civil War time that our church, church?
Kind of, there have been ups and downs in the seminary mm-hmm. policies and intentions around this. I mean, there were black students in the 19th century, and then there was a desire to
And also too, sorry, I'm gonna get to you in a second. Also too, it was interesting trying to find who the black students were, because there's not like a list of all the black students. I really had to like dig and look. So I went through these old photo albums, which are kind of cool, look like kind of Harry Potter books, but they were like these books from, you know, the 1800s, class photos, and I'm trying to look to scan to see if I see any brown or black faces, and then trying to figure out what their names were. But it was what was helpful was looking at where they lived, because many of the black students lived on Witherspoon in that area. So it was pretty cool doing some investigating work and finding these people, because they're not just readily available for us to look at. Is your question?
That was a wonderful introduction to yourself, your church, your education, your goals. I think we ought to have you back for the next chapter. Well, let me suggest this. Can you comment on or tell me what is critical race theory? How do you teach it? How do you feel about it? Forgive me if you can't do it in 25 words or less.
I did not. I will say that I did not take that class. There is a class on campus, but I did not take that class. I do not feel that I can really speak on it, but I believe that it is just sharing that race is an issue and that white supremacy does exist, and it is active in our world and society today. And I believe that we are learning about it, because people still do not realize what it is and how it is affecting people, because it can be very subtle. There are other professors here you could that might be able to speak to it, but I have not taken that course yet.
I apologize if I put you on the spot. You seem like the perfect person to be able to offer for
that. Tell me about the kind of materials you found that you could get this
I was looking at. So Princeton Seminary has a special collections in the library. And so in there, students, prior to 50 years from now, every student has an alumni file. And in that file, it has their applications, it has correspondence from them and other school administrators. Also, anytime they were found in the newspaper, well, not all the time, but if they had anything significant in the newspaper, it was put in those student files. I also was looking heavily in different PTS newsletters. Also, at the time, we should probably bring it back now, but at the time, students had different books where they would write their opinions about things that were going on around in the nation. Because I thought it was important that, you know, you could read, you know, papers from the president, but they're most likely going to be very, you know, positive and fluffy. Everything's great. Don't you love it here, guys? But so I wanted to see, you know, what the students were saying about what was going on. And so those things are really, really cool. And seeing them kind of go back and forth about different elections, about talking about the Vietnam War, different things that, you know, that were taking place, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and how the school responded to that. And they had prayer vigil services. They had a whole Martin Luther King week. It wasn't just, you know, now we just have a lecture, but they had a whole week, and students were organizing. They were raising money, having fundraisers to send to churches that were burned down, and there were definitely students that were active in that, and we definitely had students that traveled down south to participate in those demonstrations and all of those things.
Mm-hmm. 50 years from now, what do you see yourself as having accomplished?
Well, hopefully.
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I keep forgetting to ask. So someone asked, where do I see myself 50 years from now? And so I see myself as a Princeton Seminary graduate, Rutgers University graduate. I see myself as fully ordained an itinerant elder in the AMI Church. We have our first ordination, which is for itinerant deacon, and then we have itinerant elder. So I'm going for itinerant elder. And I also plan on becoming a licensed clinical social worker. Hopefully I will have a center of my own working with youth and their families in low-income areas. I also plan on, I'm not sure what exactly, but I definitely feel also passionate about working with pastors and self-care of pastors and their mental health. I think that there are a number of church leaders that are just tired out, and I feel we have to get serious about rest, the importance of rest. We also have to get serious about the way we're taking care of ourselves, people that are work with people, period, not just in ministry. But so yeah, I see myself actively involved in clinical work and also actively involved in ministry, and also taking some of the things that I've learned from my clinical work into ministry, because I do find it important that we have ministers, we have clergy that are knowledgeable in mental health, because I believe that there has been harm done due to the lack of understanding about mental health. Because a lot of times where it is seen as a spiritual thing, sometimes there's this idea that, you know, if you're depressed, that, you know, that makes you less Christian or less faithful, or it's some type of demon. And so I think that there's definitely work that can be done in both spaces. Yes?
I'm lucky I have a microphone, so you don't have to repeat my question. I'm really curious. Thank you so much for your presentation. It was very powerful, and we really enjoyed listening to it. And but I was really curious is what strategies you use between pursuing 2 degrees at the same time and having an active ministry. How do you accomplish finding that time to rest?
Mm. Well, I'm intentional about it. I have a stop time. So if I'm working on something, I have a stop time where I'm going to stop, and I will get the rest of it done tomorrow. Also something that I tell other students that are first year, second years, that it's imperative that you are making time for God, because it's very easy to become overwhelmed with school and activities and forget to make time for God. And there are different ideas, there's different things that you are learning about, and it's important that God is with you through these things. So for me, I take seriously my time with God and also just my time with myself. I have a planner, it's color coordinated. I also have a dry erase board because I'm a visual person, so I have to see it. Everything the night before, I take a list of the things that I need to accomplish that day for myself. I'm not sure about anybody else, but if I look out and see all of the things I need to accomplish, I'll become super overwhelmed. So it's important for me to keep it just day by day. This is what I need to worry about today. Today, this is what I need to worry about. So that's what I do. It's really important to be honest with people, your support system, about where you are with things. If you're just like, hey, today I'm not feeling good. Today I feel like I don't deserve to be here. I feel incompetent. just having a support system that you can be honest with instead of bottling those things in. Also, the mental health services at Princeton Seminary has been really great. Been using that as a great resource. So those are some of the things that I do. I also love music. I also am a praise dancer. so that's a way that I experience God, and something that I enjoy doing. But you definitely have to be intentional about it, and you definitely, for myself, I definitely have to be in constant communication with God throughout it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the congregation, the Heard congregation, where you and your husband are serving? And does it make a difference that he's already an itinerant elder and you're an itinerant deacon in terms of the expectations of the congregation?
The congregation's predominantly Black congregation. It's also predominantly seniors. It's one of our older churches, and it's a pretty strong congregation. They are, like, when we got there, they were already kind of a well-oiled machine. they have a bunch of different things going on, and some churches can be a little skeptical of younger people coming in, but they've been pretty great and open to our new ideas, because at the end of the day, I think that they know that we definitely need to get some younger people in here. So that's the church. As far as him being an itinerant elder, and he's the pastor, I'm not the pastor, but just as far as his ministerial staff, it's pretty much just me. I'm learning how to kind of balance, understanding that he is the pastor and, you know, hey, this is your thing, I'm here to help, not kind of overstepping my boundaries. But I think it's different for them because they're used to this, like, first lady idea. I'm not sure if you guys have that, but in the Black church tradition, we have first ladies, and the first ladies are the pastor's wives. And so I think just trying to figure out, okay, we have a first lady, but she's also a minister. And so they've been open and welcoming to me. I preach, not every Sunday, he preaches every Sunday, but I preach at least probably once a month. I'm involved in the Bible studies, in the meditations and things like that. We've only been there for a little over a year, which was interesting because when we got there, it was completely virtual. So that was another interesting thing we had to navigate, trying to meet people in this pandemic. Not being able to see all of your members, it was just very strange, but we tried to creatively figure out how to do that by doing virtual fellowship things, making phone calls, stopping by, waving at people from the doors, from the doors of their home. That's been my experience at that particular church. There are churches that I will say, to be honest, that are still apprehensive about women in ministry roles or even pastors. I know there are churches that once a pastor leaves, they request not to have a woman pastor. So we still have a ways to go, but for the most part, we are okay.
Thank you very much, Camaria. Thank you, everybody. I can tell you know what you're doing with time management. You ended perfectly, right on time at 10:20, and there are no more questions, apparently. But if you do want to talk with Camaria some more, she'll be here for a few minutes. And I just want to give a plug for next week. We start our LinkedIn learning small groups. We'll be talking about the same passages in the Bible, throughout the Bible, using the theme of reunions. And we'll also have people preaching on that same scripture topic each week. Next week, it'll be Jacob and Esau, and we'll have Princeton Theological Seminary's Ann Stewart here to share with us. So we hope you'll all come back. Thanks, everybody.